Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event in association with Humanities West. Humanities West is going to be putting on a program on the Vikings this weekend at Memorial Theater, Marines Memorial Theater. And Professor Rugg tonight from UC Berkeley, where she is a professor of Scandinavian studies, is going to speak to us about the end of the Vikings. It didn't just happen because they ran out of places to raid. Thank you very much.
Good evening. It's good to see so many people here to listen to some people who no longer exist, supposedly. This is what I'm saying. It's the end of the Vikings. I'm actually a modernist. I'm trained as a modernist. But as all people who work in Scandinavian culture, I, too, had to study Old Norse, and I had to study the Vikings. And I loved it. I really loved it. And the reason one has to do that is because the Vikings are still very much alive today, despite the title of my talk. So I'm going to be using a couple different sources. I gave you a slide that you all had plenty of time to read. You had lots of time to get through that slide. And I just also wanted to let you know that the sources that I'm going to be using, because I'm a literature person, there are lots of different ways to study the Vikings, but I'm going to be talking about literature. And two different things. I'm going to be talking about sagas, which are long prose narratives, which were written down in the 13th century, the 1200s, by Christian Icelanders. And they're based on oral tradition. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then I'm going to refer to the great work on Scandinavian mythology. If any of you have studied Thor and Odin or anything, this is the base work of Snorri Sturluson's Prose Edda. So those are the sources that I'm going to use. So I put a little question mark after my title just to show you that I really understood that it was provocative and not totally true. And we can see that it's not totally true because there are all kinds of Viking stuff still happening today. And I like this one because you probably can't read it, but underneath Thor it says, "Courage is immortal." Okay, so this idea of the immortality of the Vikings is also kind of key to what I'm thinking about today. But what I'm going to be looking at is the conversion of the Vikings, how they converted to Christianity. And when people talk about the age of the Vikings historically, they very often demarcate it with these two dates. Anytime you create a historical period and you pick dates, you're doing so in order to create a certain kind of narrative. So what these dates tell us, that the narrative that we're creating about the Vikings is, first of all, in 793, there was a major raid on a monastery in Lindisfarne, which was a monastery on an island off the coast of northern England, Northumbria, near Scotland, right? And it happened that Lindisfarne actually was also a very important scriptorium. That is, they were creating beautiful manuscripts at Lindisfarne. And so this big raid took place in 793. So it's often noted as the beginning of the Viking Age, even though it wasn't the first raid, but it was a major one, and they made out really well. And so that was one reason. And it was also described in detail in the histories, and therefore we have a record of that raid. So when we look at these dates, 793, 1066, one of the things it tells us is that we're defining Vikings as raiders, but we're also defining them as heathens. Because the end of the age, 1066 AD, which all of you will recognize because you all had to learn that date in history, right? So it's the Battle of Hastings, right? And you may not have associated it with the end of the Viking Age, but there's a complicated reason for that, which I can't explain. But essentially, at this point, Scandinavian culture becomes integrated with Christian culture. And the Scandinavian pagan culture fades out around this time. So this is what marks the beginning and the end. Now, this is a children's book, if you can believe that. That's showing you the raid on Lindisfarne, supposedly. There are a number of historical inaccuracies in this picture. Vikings did not have horned helmets. The Minnesota Vikings also used the horned helmet. That was not a real thing. And Vikings were really not interested in burning books. If the books happened to burn, that was, you know, part of the deal. But they didn't come there to burn books. They came there to get booty. They came there to get gold. And that was where the gold and stuff was located, was in the monasteries, these chalices, beautiful vestments, and things like that. So, but it's interesting that the author of the children's book wants to highlight the anti-book culture of the Vikings, because Christianity is really defined by the book, right? And the Vikings did not have books. Also, in the period 793 to 1066, their culture was based on orally transmitted wisdom, right? So they had poetry, they had mythological poetry, they had laws, they had incredibly intricate laws that they memorized. Right, they had a guy who every year in Iceland would stand on a rock and recite one third of the legal codex, and so it got recited fully every 3 years. So they had an oral culture that was very rich, but they didn't have the technology. I would call it technology to create manuscripts until they themselves become Christians. Right, conversion in Iceland happens in the year 1000, and so I'm going to really focus in on Iceland, because in Iceland we have a beautifully related conversion story that, and also the moment of conversion in Iceland can be pinpointed. Of course, it's not as clean as that, but there is a moment at which conversion takes place. And what interests me as a modernist and what I looked at all these years in Icelandic accounts of the conversion process is how the Icelanders both decide to convert to Christianity and retain a strong attachment to the pagan past. And they're able to do that better than other Christians, partially because of their remote location, because they don't have as much surveillance from the church, and they have a little bit more independence, but also because there's this incredible wave of literary creation that goes on in the 13th century, the 1200s, that in which they record their past. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today. We see this nostalgia for the past, we see this attachment to the past, and we see this really productive literary material that gets that is a very rich wellspring of knowledge for us about what the pagan Germanic peoples, not just the Icelanders, but the Scandinavians, the Germans, and the English all believed. But this is really the only full record that we have. So the conversion in Iceland, the place where I'm going to take the story is from one of the great sagas of Icelandic literature, Njálssaga, and you can find it in chapters 100 to 105 in Njálssaga. It's not the only place you can find it. There are other references to this story in Icelandic literature, and Njálssaga is pulling it from one of these other places, but this is one of the places where it's told very beautifully. What do we find out in this? Well, we find out that Olaf Tryggvason, who was the king of Norway at the time, becomes a Christian and decides that everybody else has to become a Christian too. And his methodology for making other people Christians is very violent and coercive, I would say. The Icelanders were not ruled by Norway, but they had a very strong connection to Norway. They had the Icelandic people predominantly had come from Norway originally and settled Iceland. And also their trade was with Norway. Their family relationships were all with Norway. They still sort of considered themselves having their homeland or their roots in Norway. And they sailed back and forth from Norway, almost the way people go up and down the Atlantic seaboard on Amtrak. I mean, they were always going back and forth between Norway, according to their own writings. So anyway, Olaf Tryggvason becomes the king, and he becomes Christian, and he decides he's going to convert all the Norse pagans. And so he sends missionaries to Iceland. And one of the most important of these is this guy he's talked about in Njálssaga, is this guy Thangbrand. I'm pronouncing this in Midwestern American. Okay, Thangbrand. Thangbrand came originally from Saxony, which is in northern Germany today. But he was sent by King Olaf, and his job was going to be to convert the Icelanders, which is a pretty difficult task to be set, right? So I'm going to tell you I usually walk around when I'm teaching. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a couple stories about Thangbrand because they're really good. So Thangbrand goes to Iceland, and there are a number of ways that you can try to persuade people to become Christians. And one way that you may be familiar with is you try to make it seem like there are elements of Christianity that can be mapped onto their religious beliefs already. So he's staying in Iceland with this guy named Hall, H-A-L-L, Halls. Icelanders only have one name because they don't have surnames usually. They have patronymics, so they usually go by one name, like Björk, the singer, you know, her, right? So anyway, Thangbrand comes, and he's living with Hall. And one day, Thangbrand goes out, and he sets up an outdoor altar, and he starts saying Mass. And it's St. Michael's Day, and so he's celebrating St. Michael. And Hall comes over, and Hall's just kind of standing there watching. You know, it's very interesting. He hasn't seen this before. And he says, hey, what dís are you honoring here? A dís in Icelandic is, you have the big gods like Odin and Thor and Frey and Freya. A dís is a personal god, like smaller gods that belong to you personally and protect you. So we might, dís is often translated as guardian angel, right? It's not really an angel, but that's how we sometimes translate it. So he says, what dís are you celebrating? And he says, oh, it's St. Michael. You know, and he's like, yeah, what kind of guy is that? Oh, he's very powerful. He's very powerful. You know, he can distinguish between good and evil, and he's going to defend you. And I mean, St. Michael is actually a really great dís because, you know, he's the head of the army of, you know, and he's a sword wielding kind of guy. And so Hall is very impressed, and Hall says, well, could he be my dís? Oh, yeah, no problem. Okay, so you and your whole family, you can get baptized, and then Michael will be your dís. And he's like, well, can I have your oath on that? Because in Scandinavia, if you give an oath, it's very serious. And he says, yeah. And so Hall and all his family get baptized. Well, let's consider whether Hall really understands what baptism means or whether he really understands what just happened. But that's okay. You can chalk those up for Thangbrand, right? Because they count, even though they don't really know what they're doing. Thangbrand encounters people who really resist him. So another methodology that he uses is violence. He has a crucifix and he uses it as a weapon. He wangs people with the crucifix. And he also runs spears through people and so on. But he has a lot of trouble with the Icelanders. There are a lot of Icelanders who are very stubborn about their beliefs. He has to confront a berserk warrior who challenges him, and they have a test by fire in which, you know, he gathers with a bunch of pagans and some Christians, and then he says to the berserk, okay, we're going to have three fires. I'm going to bless one, the pagans are going to bless another, and we're going to have a control fire that nobody is going to bless. And then you have to run through these fires, and if you can run through my fire, that means that, you know, that Christianity is no good. But if you can't go through and we know this trial by fire from other contexts in the medieval period, but the pagans also believed in this trial by fire thing. Of course, it turns out that the berserk is totally unable to run through the fire, and so they all kill him, right? And so then Christianity prevails. And so, yeah, and so then they have, like, there are a number of confrontations that are really interesting because if you think about the fact that the person who's writing this down is a Christian, the way in which the pagan material is presented is very objective, I would say. There's no judgment sort of attached to the pagan material. It's just kind of right there. So at one point, Thangbrand has a shipwreck. His ship is called the Bison, and it gets wrecked. And there's a poem that this woman recites to him saying, Thor killed your buffalo, you know, because Thor was the god of weather and storms, and the shipwreck happened in a storm. So from the pagan point of view, Thor had killed the Christians, right, had destroyed their ship. And this was a commonly held view among the pagan Vikings is like, well, really, this Jesus guy is not he's not that powerful, right? And so that was one of the things that the missionaries had to contend with. Another thing was that there was magic among the pagans, and Thangbrand actually encounters a magician that opens up a big abyss, and Thangbrand's horse falls into it and is never seen again. And Thangbrand is very upset by the reception that he gets. And so he goes back to Olaf and he says, these Icelanders, they're completely obstinate. I can't get them to convert. And Olaf then imprisons all of the Icelanders that happened to, well, not all of them, but all the pagans that happened to be present in Norway at the time, which were quite a few, and says, I'm going to kill these people. And so a couple of the Christian Icelanders step up and say, okay, no, don't kill them. We're going to go back to Iceland. We're going to persuade the Icelanders. We're going to make them understand the way of God. And so he releases the Icelanders. They go back to Iceland. But now there's this huge factionalized Iceland, which is a situation that we may recognize from our own society today. So there's a big tribe of Christians, and there's a big tribe of pagans, and they're opposed to one another. And every year, let's see what the slide says. I always get away from my slides. These slides are nothing more than a small hint of what I'm actually doing. Okay. It's just sort of trying to keep me on track a tiny bit. So there's this meeting that occurs every year in Iceland called the Althing. The Althing is the National Assembly, is what we might call it. Okay. Today, the Althing is the Icelandic Parliament. It's the oldest existing government in the world. But at that time, it met in the open air. Those of you who have been to Iceland, how many of you have been to Iceland? Yeah, this is a new thing we could talk about. But anyway, a lot of people have gone to Iceland. And there's an open air place called Þingvellir. And that's a place where they would help. They would go with their tents and they would hold the Althing. And it was supposed to be peaceful. When you went to the Althing, everybody was supposed to leave their weapons at the door. There was the weapon taking, it was called. They took the weapons and they put them at the door and everybody was supposed to be peaceful. But that year at the Althing, tempers were running extremely high because they knew that there was this conflict between the Christians and the non-Christians. And the saga says, a battle that would have involved the whole Althing was imminent. Everyone thought the situation looked very ugly. Okay. So they have to resolve this problem between the Christians and the non-Christians. So how are they going to do it? They adopt a very odd method. So the Christians and the pagans each chose a person to represent them. But what the Christians did, and this was Hall, actually, the guy that got baptized, whose deist is Michael. Okay, so Hall chooses a pagan to represent the Christians. He says, I'm going to pay you. He pays him a little. He goes, I want you to go off and meditate on this question, and whatever you decide, we're going to abide by your decision. And the saga says, this was taking a risk. Ah, duh. But the guy goes off and he puts a cloak over his head and he sits by himself for a whole day. And his name was Þorgeir. And Þorgeir goes off and then he makes his announcement. He says, the next day people gathered at the Law Rock. The Law Rock was a place where the law sayer guy would stand and recite all of the laws. Þorgeir asked to be heard at the Law Rock and said, quote, it seems to me that an impossible situation arises if we do not all have one and the same law. If the laws are divided, the peace will be divided, and we cannot tolerate that. Now, therefore, I want to ask heathens and Christians whether they will accept the law which I am about to proclaim. So he had to accept before he proclaimed it. Okay, and they all agreed. Thorgeir insisted on oaths and binding pledges, so this oath thing is sacred. You have to, so it's going to be taken seriously. And they gave him their pledge. And then he said, the first principle of our laws is that all men in this land shall be Christians and believe in the one God, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and renounce all worship of idols. So there we had it. Period. And it says, the heathen felt they had been grossly betrayed. But despite this, the new faith became law and the whole land became Christian at that moment. Okay. After that, people went home from the Althing. They always say that in the sagas. Every time they depict the Althing, they say, after that, the people went home from the Althing. Okay. Now, obviously, if you declare something as a law, like that and say, okay, we're all Christians. That obviously doesn't mean that we stop having pagan beliefs, but it means that the law became governed by Christianity, which is a different issue, right? And so what you have in Iceland is a cleaner break with the pagan past, but it is a structural break or an institutional break. It's not a personal break necessarily. Of course, there were people who personally decided to become Christians, but there were a lot of people who upheld their old beliefs while being subject to Christian law. Now, what happens then is that 200 years later, we have this wave of people who start to write down the information about the pagan past. They start to write down the poems. They start to write down the mythology. They start to write down the history. They start to write down their own history of Iceland, the history of the Norwegian kings. They write down ancient stories that they know. And this indicates something to us. It indicates that the oral tradition had survived, that people were still telling the stories. Over those 200 years, people were still sharing the stories. It also tells us that there was a danger, there was a feeling that these things might not survive much longer. There was a political reason for this that I could go into. I won't go into all the politics. But basically, there was a need to hold on to, rescue, and recuperate the past for the future to make sure that it would survive. So there's this guy, Snorri. He's one of the big guys of Icelandic history. Should be actually one of the big guys of world literary history. And those are his dates. He was a poet. He was assassinated in 1241. So that's because he was a politician, not because he was a poet. So, but that he was assassinated, and that story is kind of interesting, but I don't have time to tell it right now. He was the one who wrote down the prose version of the mythology, the prose Edda. He recorded it. And he kind of created a narrative frame for it also. Snorri was raised by a man who was not his own father. A lot of times in Scandinavia, you would be a foster child to someone else. And we still have that, we still use that term today in our culture, but it means something slightly different. The word foster is from Scandinavian, and it refers to the fetus in the womb, a foster. But the verb fostra means to nurture something, right? And so if you had a child and you wanted to be good friends with someone, or you wanted their protection, or you owed them a debt, or you were somehow in trouble with that person, you could offer them your child to raise. Here, you raise my child. And that creates a stronger bond between the families, and it might smooth over a misunderstanding or show goodwill. But in any case, there was a dispute that's kind of fun, but I'm not going to tell you about it. All this stuff, I'm like, go read the sagas. go read about them. Okay, so, but Snorri was handed over to this guy who had a library. Now, if you imagine, at the time, there were no printed books, right? So a library was a very valuable thing. Everything was written by hand. And it was a very erudite man. So he got this education, and he himself then was guided into being able to be a writer and a poet. And he takes the initiative to record these myths of the pagan ancestors. Now, one of his major intents was not necessary. I mean, he wanted to maintain the myths, but he was really interested in keeping a certain form of poetry alive. It's called skaldic poetry, S-K-A-L-D-I-C, skaldic poetry. And that poetry depends on a strong knowledge of the old mythological material. He also wanted to teach people the meter, you know, how to do it. And so there are two parts to his book, Prose Edda, but we usually just read the part with the stories. We're not really, only the really nerdy nerds read the part with the meters, and yeah. But that was what was interesting to Snorri. When you read the Prose Edda, he is very cagey about introducing his mythological tales. He wants to tell these pagan stories, but he knows that we can't look as if we still believe in the pagan stories. So when he opens the prologue to the Prose Edda, he says, in the beginning, Almighty God created the heavens and the earth and everything that pertains to them. So he begins the prologue to the Prose Edda the same way that Genesis begins. And then he talks about Noah and the ark. And so we're all firmly grounded in a Christian tradition as we go into this text. But then he goes off the rails just a tiny bit. And he says, and even after God saved people after the flood, then again they forgot God's name. They just forgot who God was, right? But he says, and this is the interesting rhetorical thing that he does. He says, nevertheless, God granted men the earthly gifts of wealth and happiness to enable them to enjoy the world. He also gave them the wisdom to understand all earthly things. He's making a strong argument for his pagan ancestors not being evil people. Paganism is not associated with Satan. God blessed the pagans. He gave them a place to live. He gave them stuff to eat. They just didn't know God's name. That's going to come later for them. And by sort of recuperating them as wise people, they knew things. They knew about the world. They had wisdom, right? By recuperating them as wise people, he can then tell the mythological stories without undermining his Christian faith, right? And there are a number of elements, like at the end of the story, he kind of maps some of the mythology onto Christian mythology too. So he makes it be part of the same story: the end of the world, the rebirth of the world, the saving of the world. So he's very, very skillful at bringing the two faiths together in the same historical realm, right? So there's this literary tsunami, I asked one of my medieval, I have two medievalist colleagues. Those are the experts that were consulted for this talk. So I asked one of my medievalist colleagues, I said, why did they start writing so much? Why did they start writing so much? Because this is in the 1200s. They were writing on sheepskin, you know, which was fairly expensive. Sheep were kind of important. And they were writing on the sheepskins, and they were like using these materials. It was very hard to write these manuscripts, but there were more than 100 sagas written. And there were many manuscripts of the same saga sometimes written. So that there was this huge upswing in literary interest. And one of the reasons that is given frequently is that the creation of this literature was the way that the Icelanders became a people. They were distinct from other Scandinavians. They created this literature because part of the literature, the mythology was something that all the Scandinavians shared. But the history of Iceland is one of the things that they wrote about. They wrote about their own ancestors, how they came to Iceland, their blood feuds, all of their court cases, all of their... And these are historical in the sense that they name people and places where things actually happen. So if you go to Iceland today, which many of you have, and many more of you may, the Icelanders will say, this is where Gunnar lived, this farm here. Okay. This is where Freyfaxi was thrown off the cliff. The horse was thrown off the cliff here. You know, this kind of thing. They, first of all, they know the stories, and second of all, they can geographically locate these stories, right? And so it's very important to their creation of themselves as a people. Right. So I'm going to talk about three sagas, assuming I have time. Okay. And they're big ones. And I can only strongly recommend reading sagas to you. I've already mentioned that these are long prose narratives, some of them longer than others, some of them very long. Njál saga is very long. Written in Icelandic, so you have to think also 13th century. In Europe, in continental Europe, a lot of the writing was happening in Latin, but this is vernacular writing, okay, and it's prose writing. And again, they're based on stories that people knew, probably the oral tradition. There's a big debate among scholars about how much of this is oral, how much of this was composed. And you can, if you're interested, I can give you a bibliography to read up on that, but I'm not going to focus on that today. So I have Njál saga, where there are two friends. What I'm focusing on also here is very small moments in the sagas, or points of the sagas. In Njál saga, there are two friends. One is sort of marked as a pagan hero, and the other is a Christian hero. And there's an interesting kind of relationship there that tells us something about the relationship between Christianity and paganism. Locke's Dyla Saga, a personal favorite. It's a woman's tale. Sometimes it's people say that a woman might have written it. We don't know. These sagas were anonymously written. But the reason people say that is because it involves a love triangle and because the main person is a woman by far. I mean, she's the most important character in the saga, Gudrun. And finally, there's Egil's Saga, which is a story of the paradigmatic Viking who also is a poet, and Viking warriors were poets. That was part of being a Viking warrior. Not all of them, but he happens to be a great one. So I'm going to focus on these three sagas. Often the Icelanders just refer to Njál Saga as Njála, which means Njáls. Okay. Now I should just say as a sidebar, Njál's name is probably Irish. So O'Neill, right? So there are many Icelanders who have Irish relatives because they colonized Ireland and they also took Irish slaves. Njál's name may be Irish. This is probably one of the greatest of the sagas. It's often described that way. There are more than 24 vellum manuscripts of this saga, or parts of it have survived, right? Fragments of it have survived. So people copied it. They wrote it down. They were so intensely involved with this saga. And it's an enormous saga, so writing it 24 times would be a huge amount of sheep and a huge amount of work. Okay. It covers a 50-year-long blood feud, and it's usually the women who are causing the problems. Okay, so that's one of the issues in Njál Saga, is that there are two friends who are kind of destroyed by their women. And then it really looks very closely at the legal system of Iceland before the conversion, and looks at some of the flaws that the legal system had. So it poses paganism and Christianity at odds through the protagonist. So I'm doing a juggling act here with my notes. One second. Okay, so there are these two friends. And one of them is Gunnar. And Gunnar is really your prototypical Viking hero. And I have to read this passage too because it's just too good to miss. Gunnar lived at Hlíðarend. Hlíðarend you can still visit today. He was a tall, powerful man, outstandingly skillful with arms. He could strike or throw with either hand, and his sword strokes were so fast that he seemed to be brandishing three swords at once. Yeah, it's like a ninja warrior. He could jump more than his own height in full armor. And just as far backwards as forwards. He could swim like a seal. There was no sport at which anyone could even attempt to compete with him. It has been said that there has never been his equal. He was a handsome man with fair skin and a straight nose, slightly tilted at the tip. This is like a woman describing him, too. And he had keen blue eyes, red cheeks, and a fine head of thick flaxen hair. You can tell he died early, right? Because he was extremely well-bred, fearless, generous, and even-tempered, faithful to his friends, but careful in his choice of them. He was prosperous. Okay, he has it all. He is the Viking guy. If you compare this description of Gunnar with the description of Sigurd the Dragon Slayer in another saga, the Saga of the Volsungs, Sigurd the Dragon Slayer is the paradigmatic Germanic hero. You'll see that there's a lot of similarity. This is a type, and Gunnar is being described as being part of that type. Gunnar, however, is not an aggressive person, and he asks himself in a really interesting moment in the saga at one point when his wife has been egging him on to kill people. I have to make a sidebar for one second. To egg someone on, when I was a kid, I thought that meant you threw eggs at the person. Like, how did you egg them? Like, how did you make them do stuff by throwing eggs? But it actually is it's a word in English that we've taken from Old Norse. The word in Old Norse is eggja, and it's a verb, and it means to put an edge on something. To whet a sword is eggja. So you're making them keen to go fight or something like that, right? Okay, so anyway, his wife is a big egger, Yeah. And she, Helgen, and he like doesn't really like want to do the stuff that she wants him to do. And he asks himself at one point, why is it that I'm so reluctant to kill people? Yeah, right. But anyway, he really sees it as a problem, as a flaw in himself, right? But in any case, he is forced into a number of aggressive acts by his wife's egging, and he's outlawed as a result. To be outlawed means that the thing decides that you are no longer going to be protected by the law. Outlaw is also a word that we have from Old Norse: foster, outlaw, egg. An outlaw, we think of an outlaw as just being a criminal, quite simply, but it really means that anyone can kill you without being punished. That's what it really means, okay? So Gunnar, who's actually a rather pragmatic person, says, well, maybe I should leave Iceland for a little while. And he starts to leave, and he means to leave, but as he's riding off, his horse stumbles. This is a very, very important moment in Icelandic literature, okay? His horse stumbles, and he has to leap from the saddle. This is a quote from the saga. He happened to glance up towards his home and the slopes of Fleetrand, his farm. How lovely the slopes are, he said. More lovely than they have ever seemed to me before. Golden fields of grain and new mown hay. I am going home, and I will not go away. And this quote is something Icelanders are very fond of course. Okay. And for this decision, he loses his life because people are going to kill him. In a famous scene where Gunnar is killed, his house is surrounded by enemies who are going to burn him in the house. This is a traditional way of getting your enemies. It's considered, it's rather cowardly in a way, right? And this is a very typical, you know, Custer's last stand. He's going to defend his home by himself. And he's got this, that home is surrounded. They're setting fire to it. He's firing arrows at them. He's using his sword. And we already heard what a great warrior he was. And at one point, he's shooting arrows and his string breaks on his bow. And he turns to his wife, the one, the egger, and her name is Hallgerd. She's very famous in Iceland. And says, can I have a couple of locks of your... She had long blonde hair. He says, can I have a couple of locks of your hair to make a new bowstring? And she goes, do you remember that time you slapped me? She won't give it to him, right? These women, they're, you know. Anyway, so he defended himself with courage. And he wounded 8 men so severely that many of them barely lived. He kept on fighting until exhaustion brought him down. His enemies then dealt him many terrible wounds, but even then he got away from them and held them at bay for a long time. But in the end, they killed him. Okay. So this is a famous scene, and it should, as Americans, you should be able to recognize also this sort of last stand. You know, it's a very typical Icelandic scene. Now I want to compare Gunnar to Njal, his friend. Njal and Gunnar are best friends, and they support each other, and they're with each other on everything, but they have 2 wives who are completely impossible. So Njal was an early convert to Christianity, and this is a description of him. A man called Njal lived at Berthorskunnel. He also owned another farm, so he was wealthy and handsome, but he had one peculiarity. He could not grow a beard. Okay, I don't know what to make of that, but we'll think about it. He was so skilled in law that no one was considered his equal. He was a wise and prescient man. Prescient meaning he could look into the future, or he had a good ability to predict what was going to happen. His advice was sound and benevolent, and always turned out well for those who followed it. He was a gentleman of great integrity. He remembered the past and discerned the future. I think he's a very important character in that way because he is a convert to Christianity and he sees the writing on the wall, so to speak, but he also is someone who is cognizant of the past of Iceland. And when the conversion comes, Njal says, I support the new faith. I believe Christianity is a better religion than our old one. Those who accept it will be happy. So... And he's very much a law person, as you could understand the description. With laws shall our land be built up, but with lawlessness laid waste. Now, what's interesting to me is the parallels and the sort of the opposing of these two figures, one of whom clearly represents Christianity, the other one of whom clearly represents the pagan heroic past. And Njal's death plays into this as well, because like Gunnar, Njal has his house surrounded by people who are going to burn it down, burn him and his family in the house. And he's allowed to send out his servants and to send out the women, but the men are supposed to stay in the house and be burned. And he elects, he's going to stay in the house, and his wife, Bergthora, says she's going to stay with him and burn in the house. And their little grandson also wants to stay and burn with them in the house. And this is one of these very awful scenes in Icelandic literature where they've converted to Christianity, and the grandchild says, you know, you said we're all going to go to heaven, so I'm going to go to heaven with you, right? So it says, Njal and Bergthora lay down on the bed and put the boy between them. Then they crossed themselves and the boy and commended their souls to God. These were the last words they were heard to speak. So the death of Njal and the death of Gunnar stand in contrast to one another as two different kinds of death, with Njal's death being a Christian martyrdom, a very clearly demarcated Christian martyrdom. Okay, I'm going to go on and talk about a very different saga, a woman saga, Gudrun, the most beautiful woman ever. See, everything is superlative, right? The most amazing man, Okay, so she's the most beautiful woman ever to have grown up in Iceland, and no less clever than she was good-looking. now, Gudrun gets married four times. It's not a very fortunate thing to get married to Gudrun is actually a line from the saga. Someone says, I think I'd like to marry Gudrun. I don't know if you really want to marry. Yeah. But, I mean, in the first husband, she has a divorce, and that's really just, he's abusive towards her. And then she has a pretty happy marriage and the guy drowns and it's more or less an accident. And then she has a love affair with a guy named Kjartan, which is also an Irish name. That's Kjartan there. And things get kind of complicated at that point. So I'll see if I can run through this without losing everybody. Basically, Kjartan, whom she has a dalliance with, decides that he wants to go off to Norway. And this is very, very typical, that in order to gain, you know, respect or to make good connections, that Icelanders would go back to Norway and meet the king. That was something they did. And so Kjartan went to Norway with his foster brother. So they were, Bolli was fostered, his name was Bolli, and who was also his cousin. So the two men who were very tight, they were best friends, foster brothers, cousins, they go off to Norway together. And Gudrun is a little bit miffed about this, but she's waiting. And they go off there. And then, of course, Kjartan gets so excited. And Kjartan converts to Christianity, because this is King Olaf at the time, and he's converted everybody. And Kjartan is first a little resistant, but he decides to convert to Christianity. And he stays in Norway and kind of has a thing going on with the Norwegian king's sister. And Bolli goes back to Iceland, and taking advantage of the situation, he hooks up with Gudrun. It's like, Kjartan he's over there with the Norwegian king's sister. You know, he's not coming back for you. You don't need to worry about him. And she's very disappointed. But her brother and her father, they're all saying, you should marry this guy, Bolli. He's got a lot of money. He's going to be good to you. You should go ahead and marry him. So she goes ahead and marries him. Well, Kjartan's back in Norway, and he actually is not planning to stay. And he disappoints the Norwegian king's sister by saying, okay, I think I have to go back to Iceland. And she understands that there's a woman back there. And so she gives him this really fancy, beautiful headdress for his woman to wear when she's a bride. And so both of them are assuming that he's going to give it to Gudrun. But he goes back to Iceland, and guess what? His best friend married Gudrun while he was in Norway. And so that's not good. So he gets married to someone else and gives her the headdress. Gudrun sees the headdress on this other woman and recognizes that it should have been hers. This is kind of complicated. The thing is, it's so interesting. I have to make a sidebar. The thing that's so interesting about the sagas is their style. They tell you very little about what people are thinking. They tell you very little about their motivation. This thing happened, this thing happened, this thing happened. So they said, Gudrun saw that headdress. She turned red. What do you think? She's really mad. It turns out then later that the headdress goes missing, mysteriously. And when she's confronted about it by Kjartan, who gave the headdress to his wife, she says, well, I don't know. Maybe someone realized that headdress was meant for someone else. So she says this very sort of obliquely, but we kind of understand what happened. So this turns then into killing, of course. So Bolli and Kjartan then have to face each other. And because of this woman, the two friends who are very closest friends and basically brothers in Icelandic law have to confront each other in a fight. And it's one of the more sad scenes. So Bolli ends up killing Kjartan. But Kjartan puts his weapons aside. What Kjartan says to Bolli, Bolli turns to Kjartan and he's got a sword in his hand. He doesn't really want to kill Kjartan. And he says, Kjartan says, it is an ignoble deed, kinsman, that you are about to do. But I would much rather accept death at your hands, cousin, than give you death at mine. And with that, Kjartan threw down his weapons, and he made no attempt to defend himself. Bolli made no reply, but dealt him his death blow all the same. Then Bolli caught him as he fell, that's Scandinavian, fell, and Kjartan died in Bolli's lap. At once Bolli repented bitterly of what he had done. When Bolli went home, told Gudrun, she says she's glad because now she's getting back at her rival, you know, Kjartan's wife. But Bolli said in a sudden fury, I doubt if she will turn any paler at the news than you did, and I suspect that you would have been much less shocked if I had been left lying on the field of battle and Kjartan had lived to tell the tale. Ooh. Things are not good in that household either. But of course, then, well, Bolli has to be murdered again. There's revenge taken. And this is one of the cycles in the sagas of the revenge cycle that was so difficult. That was the problem with the Icelandic law, that someone like Njal felt that Christianity might be able to repair, was the problem with the revenge cycle. Bolli is killed. Gudrun then gets her sons to avenge Bolli's death. Gudrun ends up in a cloister. She is Iceland's first nun and anchoress. So what you have is this bizarre turn of affairs where this person who is very clearly a Viking woman in all respects, at the end of her life, goes into a cloister, right? And there's a wonderful scene that I'm not going to have time to tell you about in full detail, but her son, who's also named Bolli, comes to her and asks her, which of the four men you were married to did you love the most? And at first she's like, I don't think we need to go into that. But then finally he gets her to say, and then she says, I was worst to the one I loved the most. Yeah. So one wonders whether the entrance into the life of the nun is a kind of a penance. The very final one that I want to mention, and I know I don't really have very much time, so if I want you to be able to talk at all, is Egil's saga. And Egil is the one who is a Viking and a poet. And Egil is such a great Viking. At the age of 6, he has his first killing. He's playing ball with someone. He gets mad at the kid he's playing ball with. He goes off and gets an axe and splits the kid's skull with an axe. And the saga says, his father was not very pleased, but his mother says, he will be a great Viking. Okay? So clearly this is a pagan rules. We're playing by pagan rules now. And he lives a pagan and dies a pagan. At the end of his life, he's a very, very famous poet, a very famous warrior. But he ends very pathetically. He's blind. He's sitting by the stove. The women chase him away from the stove. And he's just a sad kind of ending. Then he dies. And Egil's bones become this very bizarre monument to the past. They bury Egil. We're told that Egil was buried in a church. And the saga says the evidence of that is that a new church was built in that space, and they demolished the old church, and they found these weird bones under the altar. And they were bigger than the bones of a usual human being, much bigger. And the skull was enormous. And one of the guys took an axe, and they tried to split the skull, and they couldn't even make a dent in it. And it just turned white, right? And it's like, okay, we're talking about the past. We're talking about the bones of the past. We're talking about the pagan tradition. And we're talking about how that tradition still exists. They put the bones then back in the ground, and they plant them. And there's Egil and his bones as a symbol of a time when people were bigger, stronger, you know, braver. And this is the heroic past that then becomes something that the Scandinavians draw on all the way into the present. I don't know if any of you, I was going to show a film, but I don't have time, where if any of you saw the Icelanders beat England in 2014 at the European Cup, 10% of the Icelandic population was in the stands. Yeah, 35,000 people went to France. And they all did this cheer. It scares the heck out of people. And they were televising it in Reykjavik, and everybody in Reykjavik was also, you know, doing this thing. And so, you know, the moral of the story is that, of course, courage is immortal. And these are church doors. I think you can't really see them, unfortunately. But there's a Norwegian church door that the carvings on either side show the story of Sigurd the Dragon Slayer. This is a detail from the door. This is Sigurd slaying the dragon. Sigurd is one of the great pagan heroes. They have him on the church door. But you're able to map that onto St. George or St. Michael, right? It still looks like it could be Christian, right? Okay, so that's all I have to say. So I just wanted to let you guys have a chance to ask questions. Thank you.
So it's time for questions. And I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Professor Linda Rugg speaking about the end of the Vikings at the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you. It was a very, very interesting talk. I've read Egli's saga myself. Uh-huh.
Good.
I wanted to ask you the replacement of the pagan matriarchal religion, you know, where the destiny of men was ordained by Valkyries, replacement by the patriarchal Christian religion must have had a serious impact on the role of women in Norse society. Yeah. And could you comment on how the role of women changed?
Oh, that's such a great question. It's such a huge question. I have a colleague named Jenny Jochens, who wrote a book on women in Viking Scandinavia, and she deals to some degree with this issue. There were, of course, I mean, on the one hand, I think we associate Christianity with being oppressive to women. And the matriarchal culture that you're talking about, there's a mythology level to that. You mentioned the Valkyries. You could also mention the Norns, right? The Norns that told the fortunes of people. The Disir are often figured as women. These personal gods I talked about. But I'm kind of backpedaling a little bit. The matriarchal culture was not so matriarchal in the sense that the actual lived culture of the people was not necessarily reflected in the mythology. So, for example, these women who were put into marriages, very often they were put into marriages by their brothers and their father that they didn't want. This is one of the things, one of the linchpins in the Scandinavian sagas. And so when we think about Scandinavian women as being very strong, the Viking women as being very strong, I think that is true, that they were often left on their own on the farm, for example, when men would go Viking and they would manage everything. And we have so many great stories about these women, like the woman who refused to give her hair for the bow, or, you know, all the trouble that they caused. But it wasn't entirely, I would say, a matriarchal culture, because the men still had a lot of power over the women in terms of marrying them. With the saga, marrying them off, and this, what the sagas show us, and again, the sagas are composed during the Christian period, so we don't know precisely how accurate everything is that they depict. They show us that men would get into a lot of trouble if they forced women into positions, right? But there was still a lot of women being treated as possessions. So it wouldn't be quite right to say that it was an entirely matriarchal culture. Now, there's a debate about whether the situation of women improved or did not improve under Christianity. One of the things that we see in the sagas, too, is that women enter this cloistered life, but that gives them a certain amount of autonomy. And that was true into the later Middle Ages, where you had women like St. Brigitte in Sweden, who becomes a prophet through her alliance with the church. I think that Christianity didn't change everything. I think the culture was very strong in a certain way, and it kept certain kinds of things kept going about women's autonomy. One of the moments in Laxdæla saga that I didn't mention is that at one point Gudrun is asked by her stepfather, well, do you want to marry this guy? You know, so they ask her. He says, you're a widow, and as a widow, you're allowed to decide. But the implication there is that if you're not a widow, that if it, you know, then you don't get to decide, right? So I would recommend her book. She'll give you, like, lots of information. Another person is Else Rosdahl. She's a Dane, and she wrote a book called The Vikings that was translated into English. And as a woman scholar, she also devotes quite a bit of time to that question. You could ask me for that reference later if you want to. Yeah.
Next question.
Thank you so much for that wonderful lecture.
Oh, thanks.
I had two questions, the first being that Niala reminded me very much of Macbeth.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask if you know of any evidence of cross-pollination from that medieval literature to Renaissance literature, mm-hmm. or is this just, you know, a patriarchal Christian influence?
No, I think, I mean, some of the, I mean, there is cross-pollination. I can give, I mean, the most obvious example that springs to mind is, of course, Hamlet. And Hamlet is, I mean, he's described as a prince of Denmark in Shakespeare's play, and he is actually a prince of Denmark. It's described in Saxo Grammaticus, the Danish historian. And so this material is, some of the material, like the mythological material, circulates. And the story of Sigurd, for example, occurs both in an Icelandic version and in Siegfried, which is the German version, written around the same time. So we know that certain stories, certain myths, certain ideas circulated among these peoples and were shared orally and sometimes then emerged into the literary practice. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does.
Macbeth is situated in Scotland, according to Shakespeare. But I think that, you know, like when I mentioned how Gunnar is supposedly a historical figure, right, in Njála saga. And but there's so obviously also an archetype mm-hmm. that's being reproduced, right? So when you have a literary practice, the writer, even if they're describing someone who supposedly really lived, will draw on an archetypal vocabulary. And I think that's one of the things you might also see.
Wonderful.
Okay.
And question number two, it's a semi-personal one.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wearing my Icelandic Mjolnir. I realize most people can't
Mjolnir.
See this.
Yeah, I can see it. I know what it is.
But I was wondering if you could tell me, I can take it off and maybe some people will see it.
It's a hammer. It's Thor's hammer.
But I wanted to just ask some more about the personal history of it, because it blends both, you know, the cross and the hammer.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And you had mentioned the crucifix being used as a weapon.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Thor's hammer, the amulet that is still popular, and you can buy it in Sweden and Iceland and lots of places, it was an amulet that was worn by pagan Scandinavians. Because Thor was called the protector of humankind, Aldeire, and you could call on him. So like if you were in trouble physically, usually physically, not mentally, because Thor wasn't big on that side. But if you're physically in trouble, you would call Thor. You would call on Thor. And Thor was supposed to come in and help you. And so the amulet was worn as a form of protection. And then when the Christians came and they wore crosses sometimes, then people saw that. Oh, yeah, okay, I recognize that. There is actually a mold that people made jewelry with where you see both Thor's hammers and crosses on the same mold. So people were like, it was in demand, both kinds, both things were in demand. I don't know if anybody ever wore both, but they were understood to have the same kind of function. I think that the cross has also a very strong identification function. That is, you were identified as a Christian if you were wearing one, where the hammer didn't have that function in the same way. I just thought of something with Macbeth. I have to go back to Macbeth for 1 second, okay? I was thinking Macbeth. So the opening scene with the three sisters, you know that they're called the weird sisters. That's what Shakespeare calls them, the weird sisters. Well, it doesn't mean just weird like we mean it, like strange. Weird refers to being able to see into the future or having prophetic power, because weird, W-Y-R-D, refers to the future or that ability to be prophetic. And so in Old Norse mythology, there are three, they're not sisters precisely, but the Norns. I mentioned the Norns when I was answering your question. So the Norns take care of the tree of life, and one of them is named Urðr, one of them is named Erani, and the other one is named Skuld. And those three names mean future, being or present, and past. And Urðr in English is weird. So the three weird sisters refer probably in some way to the Norns, who were said to be able to tell the fates of men, or who determine the fates of men. So there are, to answer your question, yes. Okay. Other questions?
Right. So yeah. This was a very interesting talk. So notice that Iceland had a parliament instead of a king. So yeah. Do you think this, the fact that they retained a lot of the pagan religion influence actually affected the form of government as well?
Well, the Icelanders were... that's a good question. So the Icelanders were they weren't a nation, of course, at the beginning when they first came to the island, but they had their system of governance, if you could call it that. I mean, it was a system of governance. They had chieftains, but these chieftains were not necessarily only hereditary offices. You had to earn a chieftaincy, and you could lose a chieftaincy and usually it depended on wealth and power. Power being coercion, your ability to coerce other people to do what you wanted them to do, but also your ability to get people to do what you wanted them to do. You know, so chieftainships shifted quite a bit, but there was a kind of, it wasn't a, I don't want to call it a democracy because that would be a misnomer, but it was a society where people didn't have a noble class in Iceland. In Norway, where they came from, they developed kingship. Around about the same time that the Icelanders were going to Iceland, the kingship was getting stronger. And it supposedly was one of the reasons that the Icelanders left. That's one of the things that people say, is that they didn't like being subjected to taxes and things like that. So they weren't under the direct rule of a king, but then they became colonized. So around about the time that the sagas are being written, they kind of become more and more under the influence of foreign power, Norway, and then Norway is ruled by Denmark, and so then Denmark becomes the colonial power for a long time. And it's not until after the Second World War that they gain independence. But the all thing, they wouldn't have a king because that was never their culture. Right. I don't know whether that has anything to do with their ability to hold on to the pagan beliefs, but certainly it has some. Definitely has something to do with the way they view themselves. And there's a wonderful novel that's written in the modern period by Haldur Laxness. He's an Icelander, called Independent People. Independent People. And this is really how the Icelanders also view themselves. And you see it played out in the saga literature, the sort of standing before the king as an independent person, right? Now, Loch Ness kind of makes fun of that. It's a great novel, though. You should read it. Yeah.
Thank you very, very much. For those of you who would like to know much, much more about the Vikings, there's this Humanities West program this weekend, and there's information in the back of the room. If you'd like, you can take that with you. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th Year of Enlightened Discussion. Thank you very much for coming.